In the early 1970s, Dr. Tad Stewart took a church, became the pastor of a church in a rather unlikely place, Tehran, Iran. That was the church he came to pastor. He and his family were there during the 1979 revolution, which drove the Shah out of power. The government under the Ayatollah closed his small, struggling Presbyterian church. There were very few members left anyway. It was pretty much dwindled down to very few people. But the government came in, burned all the Bibles, the Sunday school curriculum. Then they took a big padlock and they locked the door of the church with the padlock. They wiped their hands. They said, "Aha, we have closed Christianity in Iran." Tad Stewart and his wife opened their small home on Sunday mornings for people to come for worship. Nobody dared say where they were going. They came early in the morning while it was still dark, but church attendance grew. It doubled, and then it tripled. People smuggled in Bibles as if they were pure gold. Tad said that when he opened the Bible and read it, you could have heard a pin drop among the people. And soon that church made an impact all over the city of Tehran as house churches sprouted up. And all over the nation of Iran as they spread. And even over part of the Middle East as the message of Christ spread through persecution. The church has always grown the most under fire, because fire purifies the church. Christians grow strongest under pressure, because pressure strengthens Christians. We grow best in God's unlikely places. Now in Genesis chapter 46, the passage we come to this morning, God is moving Israel out of the promised land. They are leaving their homeland and into Egypt. Why? It is all part of God's strategic plan to grow a family into a nation. God moves us, God moves you and me into places we would not choose as well. Why? It is all part of God's strategic plan to grow us into His church. God may be putting you under pressure right now. It's because God is at work in your heart. He wants you to come to Him. Fear drives us to God. Afraid, we seek God. Verse 1 of chapter 46. So Israel... He's been renamed, Jacob's been renamed as Israel, as you remember. So Israel, Jacob, set out with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes." Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. They took their livestock and their property which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and they came to Egypt. Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his grandsons with him, his daughters and his granddaughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. So Jacob and his family head on the at least a month-long journey from Canaan down to Egypt. Jacob is 130 years old. No spring chicken here. He's 130 years old. And he's leaving home, knowing he will probably never return. He stops in Beersheba on the way. Beersheba, if you know anything about the map of Palestine, Beersheba is the southernmost point, the southernmost town, I should say, in the land of Canaan, in the Promised Land. So once he leaves Beersheba, he is leaving his homeland. He is leaving the promised land, the land God promised to him and his descendants. And he's entering the desert regions that lead to Egypt. Jacob had never been beyond Beersheba. And Jacob is afraid. We know he's afraid because the first thing God says to us is, "Don't stop being afraid." So we know he's afraid. A change is tough anytime. And when you are 130 years old, change must be really tough to deal with. I can think of several reasons why Jacob would be afraid. First, his family had bad memories of Egypt. Egypt had not been friendly to his family. His grandfather Abraham, in particular, Abraham, you remember, had a very bad experience in Egypt back in Genesis chapter 12. Secondly, Egyptians held a long-standing hatred of Semitic people like Jacob. They were a pagan country filled with the worship of gods and goddesses. They were not friendly to his faith. Third, he was leaving home. Jacob was an old man. It's hard to make such a huge move as you get older. He was uprooting his whole family. His entire way of life was changing. And fourth, God had warned them all through Abraham that terrible, terrible struggles were coming for the family, for the people in a foreign country. And Jacob had to wonder if Egypt was the foreign land God had predicted to his father, Abraham, so many years ago. Let's look at that passage in Genesis 15. God said to Abram in Genesis chapter 15, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years." Now, God told Abram this a couple hundred years before this time when Jacob is living, but it surely was passed on to him. He knew all about this promise. "They will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years, but I will judge that nation whom they serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. In the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." The Amorites were the ones who were living in Canaan. So Abram was in Hebron when God spoke those words to him a couple hundred years earlier. And Jacob had just left that region of Hebron on his way to Egypt. And surely the prophecy about leaving the land and coming back to the land made him think of his situation. He could not have helped but think about it and fear for it. Jacob knew that 400 years of suffering were coming for his people before they return to the land. Notice how long-suffering God is, how patient he is. In this case, toward the Amorites. Why did God say there would be this long period of time? Because the sin of the Amorites was not complete. The Amorites are the inhabitants of Canaan. Their sin is not complete. And so, years and years later, when the Israelites under Joshua enter the land of Canaan and they destroy the inhabitants, the Amorites there in the land of Canaan, they are fulfilling God's prophecy. What had happened was God was allowing the land mercy. For 400 years he would give them mercy, but eventually their sin would reach such great proportions that God would judge the land of Canaan. And he would use Israel and bring them back in. You see, a nation's sin reaches a point where God's mercy ends and judgment begins. That's all part of God's plan. But meanwhile, God was moving his people away from all of that sin in the land of Canaan, into a land where they could grow into a nation. And they would be enslaved, but the slavery would be the means by which God would used to keep them pure and draw them to himself. I mean, no wonder Jacob's afraid. This is a rather daunting expectation. So he does what we should do when we are afraid. What should you do when you're afraid? Seek God. He worships God at the altar of his father, and God speaks to Jacob. God tells Jacob, Don't be afraid, I'm with you. I am moving you, God says. It's my plan, I'm moving you to Egypt. And Jacob, your son Joseph will close your eyes. You're going to die there. You will not come back to this land now. You will die. Your son will close your eyes, but he will bring you back to the land I have promised you. God reassures Jacob with his love. I mean, you may be facing some very difficult circumstances in your lives. I don't know. Changes are happening. Tough things are going on. You're afraid for the future. Come to God today. Come to Him. Seek Him. Let Him meet you. Let Him love you. Let Him reassure you. Take care of you. You may still face tough times. God doesn't promise us that we will not suffer or struggle in this life. I really appreciated Heather's words where she talked about the ongoing storms of life. There's a young Christian who knows that as tough as she's been through things with her brother and the death of her brother, there are still storms, there are still struggles. God doesn't promise us the easy life. But He does say, I'll be with you through it all. So seek me. And you can face whatever comes by His grace and strength. Can you imagine what it would be like to lose three generations of your family in one moment? That's what happened in 1991 to Jerry Sitzer. He was a professor at Whitworth University in Washington. He and his wife, Linda, their four children, his mother, Grace, they'd been on a trip to a Native American powwow in Idaho. As they were returning home, a car with a drunk driver going 85 miles an hour slammed into them head on. And in an instant, Sitzer lost his mother, his wife, and their youngest daughter. Three generations. In his book, A Grace Disguised, Sitzer describes with really powerful honesty what it was like to suddenly be a single father, broken, depressed, wanting to just quit it all. Life wasn't worth it. One night, he said he had what he called a waking dream. The sun was setting, and it was getting dark, and he was frantically going west, chasing the sun, the last elements of life, and he couldn't catch up with the sun, he said in his dream. And slowly darkness closed in around him. Darkness enveloped him, and he was lost in the darkness. Shortly after that dream, his sister Diane, talking with him, and he told her about the dream, and she said, look, the quickest way to reach the sun is not to go west, but to go east. Run into the darkness until you find the sun. And he said that changed his perspective on life. He wrote in his book, I discovered in that moment that I had the power to choose the direction my life would head. I decided from that point on to walk into the darkness rather than to try to outrun it, to let my experience of loss take me on a journey wherever it would lead, and to allow myself to be transformed by my suffering rather than to think I could somehow avoid it. Amazing, isn't it? Running into the darkness until we come to His light, for He is there. So afraid, we seek God in the darkness. Secondly, all in, we start small. All in, we start small. Beginning in verse 8, we have this nice big genealogy. God puts these genealogies in here for a reason. I'm not going to read through all of the verses and pronounce all of those names right now. But the upshot of it all is there were 70 in the family as they settled in Egypt. Drop down to the end of the genealogy, verse 26. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, his direct descendants, not including the wives of Jacob's sons, were 66 persons in all, and the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2. All the persons of the house of Jacob who came to Egypt were 70. Like we've seen with other genealogies in the book of Genesis, this is a representative number. 70 is kind of a representative number. Other texts actually speak of 75 in the family, depending upon who they're counting in the family, and even some members, you notice, are not mentioned in this count as well. The whole point is that the entire family went to Egypt. They were all in. Everybody went. Jacob didn't leave some members of the family back there to hold things down until they could get back to home. They all left home, and they all went to Egypt. That's the point of verses 26 and 27 and the genealogy. They were committed to following God into this new life. They were all in. The number 70 also emphasizes how small the group was. 70 people entering the land of Egypt. The Egyptians went, who cares? It's a family. No big deal. They were tiny. They were insignificant. Remember this, God had promised to make a great nation out of Abraham, right? He had promised Abraham that he would make a nation out of him that would be like the sands on the seashore, like the stars in the sky, Abram. We've gone through 215 years since God made that promise to Abram. Over 200 years, and we're 70? Where's God's promise? What's God doing? Where's the great nation, God? Not grand at all, not great at all. Yet during the next 400 years in Egypt, they would grow into a nation of 2 million. 2 million. They would become like the stars in the sky. Egypt was God's incubator to grow a nation. With all of the suffering, with all of the struggle that they would go through, Egypt was God's incubator to grow his nation. Moses in Deuteronomy told the people, your fathers went down to Egypt, 70 persons in all, and now the Lord your God has made you as numerous as the stars of heaven. He said that when he was leading them out of the land of Egypt. The promise is fulfilled, but it came through Egypt and through the struggles of 400 years. See, God starts small but grows big. Don't despise the smallness of your situation, because God often starts slowly. He begins small. You look around and what you're doing seems tiny in comparison to what is going on everywhere else. But God lays a foundation in your life slowly, and then grows your ministry, grows what you are doing and your life to accomplish his goals. We want it to all happen like that. We want to be great and big immediately. God doesn't work that way. The real question, the key question, is not how small your resources, but how big your commitment. It's not how small your resources, it's how big is your commitment. That's the key. Are you all in with God? And Christianity is not something to be casual about. If you want to follow God, you got to be all in. If you want to follow Jesus, you got to be committed. And if we're all in, then God does great things. God does good things in our lives, through us and in us, no matter how small we might seem to others. I grew up under the rule, thou shalt not play with playing cards. Maybe some of you had that rule too. Thank you, Dad. I went to a Bible college, and for 4 years I lived under the rule, thou shalt not play with playing cards. Now, we could play with rook cards, and you can play any game you want with rook cards. So rook became the sanctified playing deck in college, in Bible college, dormitory rooms. After I graduated from Bible college and I was married, we lived near Janie's parents. While she was going to school for 4 years, I was working in the factory. Many times on the weekends, we would get together with her mom and dad to play cards because they love playing cards. So I learned to play cards. Her dad passed away of Alzheimer's a number of years ago, but he was a sharp card player. One of those guys that counted everything in the deck in his head, you know, and knew what was coming and what was being played and everything. And it was always guys against girls. So it was her dad and me against her mom and her. And we kept a logbook. You ever have these family things going? We kept a logbook of the wins and losses as it went through several years of time. He taught me to play cards, and so eventually I got good enough that I wasn't a handicap to him, understand. But there would come a point in the game, and he would take the lead, and he'd lay down a card, and he'd look across the table at me, and he'd say, "Play them like you owned them. Play them like you owned them," as he slapped the card down. And that was his cue to me to throw everything I had into the pile, because he wanted it all. He was playing aggressively. He wanted me to do the same. He was all in, and he wanted me all in. Play him like you owned him, David. Well, that's what God wants from you and me in life. He says to you and me, says to me, David, play him like you owned him. Put it all in. Throw it on the table. I'm in charge. Are you ready to play him like you owned him with Jesus? Third principle, ostracized, we grow strong. Verse 28. Now, he sent Judah before him to Joseph, that is, Jacob sent Judah before him to Joseph, to point out the way before him to Goshen. They came into the land of Goshen. Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. It's been 22 plus years now since he's seen his dad. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive. I'm ready to die now, happy. I've seen you, Joseph." Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh and will say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household who are in the land of Canaan have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And when Pharaoh calls you and says, "What is your occupation?" you shall say, "Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth, even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians." Now, Joseph arranged for the family to live in this region called Goshen, which was on the eastern side of the Nile River Delta. It was an area where they could live without much contact with the Egyptians, provided grazing pasture for their flocks and their herds. Now, I've said before in our study of Genesis that the ancient Egyptians were racist. They were very racist. And they despised Semitic people. And you can see in this little story a bit of that information. They particularly hated shepherds. Most of the Semitic peoples were nomads who had goats and sheep and were shepherds. And they hated, the Egyptians hated shepherds. They hated Semitic people. They didn't want to have anything to do with them. They wouldn't even eat dinner with them. We've already seen that in our study of Genesis, by the way. And the Semitic people were easily distinguished because the Semitic people, like Jacob's family, all had full beards. That was the Semitic way. They had these full beards. Egyptians were always clean shaven. So it was pretty easy to distinguish them. Plus, Semitic peoples, and shepherds in particular, dressed in a certain way. They lived a certain way. Quite frankly, they smelled like sheep. They were easily identified. And the Egyptians considered them uncivilized, uneducated, rude, uncouth people. And they wouldn't have anything to do with them. Now, why is that all important? Because God used the racism of Egypt to grow a nation of Israel. They would be isolated there. They would be ostracized there. So they could grow as a nation and as a faith because of the racism of Egypt. Yes, God can even use an evil like racism to accomplish his goals. The Egyptians would leave them alone. They could grow into a pure and strong nation that was following God. Egypt was the perfect incubator for growing the nation of Israel. Now, of course, as we know from Exodus, eventually the Egyptians enslaved them and oppressed them, but God also used even that slavery and that persecution and the evil that the Egyptians did to them to grow a stronger nation for him. An Amish bishop quoted in The Economist in 1989 said, "Prosperity has often been fatal to Christianity, but persecution never." The church has always grown strongest under the fire of persecution and grown the weakest and the fattest when prosperous. That is true down through history. Christians have always grown the strongest under pressure and struggle, and the weakest under prosperity and comfort. That's simply how it's been down through history. And we can see that in our country, here in America. It's easy to be a Christian in America. I put Christian in quotes there. It's getting a little harder sometimes now. That may not be a bad thing. But it's generally pretty easy to claim to be a Christian in America. Many attend church. Many people call themselves Christians who are really not Christians at all. Just in name only. They are what we might call cultural Christians. They don't really follow Christ. Persecution makes cultural Christianity impossible because you no longer have that freedom. I grew up in Pakistan. When a Muslim person became a Christian, it was a big deal. Particularly was evident when they were baptized. Why was it such a big deal? Because they would be disowned by their family. They might be beaten. There were women who were tortured because they became Christians, because they were baptized, by their own family members, an uncle or a brother. So when a person, a Muslim, became a Christian in Pakistan and decided to be publicly baptized by identifying themselves with Jesus Christ, they were taking a huge step. And I'll tell you what, there weren't too many cultural Christians. You thought long and hard before you made that decision to follow Jesus. It would cost you dearly. In their book, The Privilege of Persecution, isn't that a great title for a book? The Privilege of Persecution? Karl Moeller and David Hegg tell the following story. They are leaders of the Open Doors ministry, which, if you're familiar with it, works with the persecuted church around the world. That's who they work with. And they smuggle Bibles and commentaries into North Korea as one of the countries that is one of the most where Christians are persecuted heavily. One of the most persecuted is in North Korea. And the Yalu and Tumen rivers form a natural boundary between the People's Republic of China and the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. And night and day, soldiers guard that boundary with high-powered field glasses, these military stations, control checkpoints controlling the flow in and out of China and North Korea. And as people approach the checkpoint to go into North Korea on the Chinese side, the line slows to a snail's pace because they're very careful and very few people get into North Korea. And inside North Korea, there are checkpoints everywhere. You don't move around easily in North Korea. But one man goes in and out of the country frequently and travels around in North Korea. He works for Open Doors, but they don't even know his name. He's simply called the Traveler. He is one of the persons who distributes Bibles, commentaries, materials for Christianity in North Korea. Comes out, gets them, goes back in, and distributes them to the Christians. And he never will tell anyone his name, because if it ever got out, he'd be dead. And so would many other Christians in North Korea. And yet for years he has done this secret work. One day when he was out of the country, the leaders of Open Doors asked him what the church in North Korea prays for. What do they pray for? And this man broke into tears. He began to weep. And he told of a church movement inside North Korea that most of us know nothing about. Ever since the 1950s, because in order to wipe Christianity from the face of the land, Kim Il-sung's soldiers herded entire Christian congregations into the streets, and they ran them over with bulldozers, and they crushed them. Thousands of men, women, and children, nearly all of them North Korean citizens, were literally crushed to death, and they used their remains to line the roadbeds of the streets. Today, under Kim's son, Kim Jong-il, there are 240,000 believers in North Korea, in the underground church there. These North Korean believers, he said, pray for one purpose: to be in place and fulfill God's will for their lives. Wow. Their prayer is for liberation so they can share the gospel, for lifting of the darkness, for a possibility to reopen the churches of their ancestors, for reconciliation. That's why the Traveler continues to go in and out and bring Bibles and commentaries to the Christians, your brothers and sisters, our brothers and sisters in North Korea. Have you prayed recently for the believers in North Korea? I did this week. It's good to be reminded. But God is doing an astounding thing there under great pressure. You see, we grow best in God's most unlikely places. Now, we're not living in North Korea. We don't struggle with some of those things, but we all struggle with various issues in our lives. Know this, God is at work. And we grow best in those situations that he puts us in so that he can stretch us and grow us. Dave Harvey, in his book Rescuing Ambition, tells a story of what has been called the greatest rescue mission of World War II. Late in World War II, American bombers were sent on these dangerous missions over southern Europe trying to cripple the Nazis' oil supplies by bombing them. And hundreds of crews in these flying tin cans, these bombers, soared through all of the anti-aircraft fire to drop their shells on these on the Nazi positions. And many, many American pilots were forced to bail from their shot-up planes and come down in enemy territory. The injured airmen usually ended up floating into what is now Yugoslavia. And there they would expect to be captured or killed by the Nazis. But instead, the Serbians were watching, and they would rush as they watched the parachutes, the floating airmen come down. They would rush to the site when those soldiers, when those flyboys came down, and they would get there before the Nazis, and they would rescue them, and they would get them away from there. However, they still needed to escape. So the story of what became known as Operation Halyard builds through this whole process. They had a secret landing strip that they would get people to, an evacuation plan to get the Americans out of the country. These Serbian peasants rescued every single American airman that bailed out over Yugoslavia during the war. 500 of them they rescued. But here's the subplot. To travel to the evacuation site, they had to follow the Serbian rebels. They had to spend weeks following them as they did battle with the Nazis. They knew they were the only ones who knew the path to the evacuation. Despite the language barriers, they had to keep up with them and trust them. These men had been saved from the enemy, but the journey had just begun. They still had to walk to freedom. So the story of Operation Halyard sheds light on this spiritual reality, Dave Harvey writes. To be rescued from something sets us on the path towards something. That's the Christian life. To be rescued from something sets us on the path towards something. For the airmen, it was a journey of survival. For us, it's a journey of faith. That's the Christian life, right there. We're here in enemy territory. We're walking to freedom in Christ. See, when we become Christians, it doesn't mean we've arrived. It means we've started. We've started this long journey through a dangerous world, and it's going to be filled with struggle. I cannot promise you a life of ease as a Christian. I cannot promise you God's going to solve, fix all your problems, make you happy, wealthy, and wonderful. That's a false gospel. I can promise you this. God will be with you through whatever you go through if you're following Him. He'll care for you. He'll love you. He'll lead you through whatever struggles you have to face. That I can promise you from God's Word. And in the process, He'll grow you through the storms of life, just as He's growing Heather and many, many others. Father, teach us, grow us, move us, work in us, for You are absolutely faithful, and we can trust You on this journey. In Jesus' name, amen.